5 years now that makes me wish that I was early in my career instead of late in my career, because it was some things that somehow never occurred to me. I've spent my 40 years basically doing high-performance polymeric composites for the Air Force and NASA. Why did I choose to do that? Because that's where there's lots of research funding, and if you work at a university, then you end up doing what people are paying for, right, as opposed to what maybe you would ideally like to do. But I've discovered along the way that there are opportunities, although you have to go beat the bushes a little harder to find what some of them might be. And so I'd like to share with you what we've been doing, basically trying to convert agricultural waste into things that have real value, so that it's no longer waste and it can be something that poor farmers can sell. There are 2.7 billion people in the world, according to the... I'm trying to think who puts this kind of data out. United Nations, I suppose. 2.7 billion people live on $2 a day or less. And it turns out that 80% of that 2.7 billion are farmers. So if you want to do something to help poor people in developing countries, then you need to figure out how to do something to help poor farmers. A fellow named Paul Pollock did something really interesting. He started out by interviewing 3,000 farmers around different parts of the world and discovered that what they really needed was simple pumps that don't work with electricity but work like steppers to be able, and then they made a very, very cheap drip irrigation system, so that farmers who previously got one crop per year could get three. They only had enough rain for one crop per year, but they had sunshine the year round. These are people that live in tropical regions. And so I once asked him, because he's helped 17 million families triple their income. And that's a pretty good I would agree. And he started late in life. He was a psychiatrist before that. And when he came to Baylor and spent some time with us there, I asked him, how all the stuff he did was technical, but he did it as a psychiatrist. And he said, well, the best thing I learned as a psychiatrist was how to listen. And so I'm reminded of what you were saying about spending time talking to the people you're trying to help. A lot of times we go in and we think we know what's best, we know how to fix things, and we come in with our cultural and technical solutions to their problems, many of which are not appropriate. Or maybe we're solving problem A, where the one they really wanted you to solve was problem B, C, or D. So the project got started with me working with an old PhD student of mine who is the first person to ever get a PhD in mechanical engineering, or maybe any engineering, in Papua New Guinea. And he'd want to come back and do a sabbatical, and I said, well, what would you like to do? And he said, well, some stuff on tribology and wear, which is sort of what he did his dissertation on. And I asked him, are there a lot of tribology and wear problems in Papua New Guinea? And he said, well, not really. Tribology is lubrication, okay? So tribology and wear. And so I asked him to go find something that if we worked on it for a year might help poor people in his country. And he was the one that came back and suggested to me, let's do something with coconuts. Now, first ideas you have don't always work. We decided what we were going to do is we were going to transform the world by making coconut biodiesel for rural village electrification. I mean, this would have really been fantastic. Turns out you can make biodiesel using methanol, which is the usual way you make biodiesel, period, using coconut oil as a feedstock. The problem was that you aren't going to have methanol in rural villages. So, and it's poisonous, it's dangerous, it's explosive. I would not want to put a big 55-gallon drum of methanol there. They'd blow the village into eternity, probably. Kind of like they don't do maintenance. I don't think they understand danger or stuff like that. So we thought if we could make this out of ethanol, it could really, really help, because they could make their own ethanol, they can make their own coconut oil, and they could be totally energy self-sufficient if somebody just provided a generator. And it's easy to get donations for those kinds of one-time investments. The problem is, how do you sustain them? And we discovered if we used very, very pure ethanol from the chemistry department, no water, it made great biodiesel. But when you added 0.5% water, it made so-so biodiesel. And if you added 1% water, it really made soap. And I'm not enough of a chemist to quite know what went wrong, but if you add ethanol with very much water, it wasn't going to work. And when you make it in a rural village setting, the way that this would be done, you can't get less than probably 6 or 8% water. So we decided we're never going to be able to, and they already make soap. So We really hadn't done anything they hadn't done before. But along the way, I learned a lot about coconut husk and coconut shells. Most of you probably, if you have not been to a really tropical country, have seen coconuts at the store, but you may never have seen coconut husk. I didn't know coconuts came in husk. I'm kind of like the New York kid that thinks milk comes in cartons, you know. And so it was quite interesting for me to learn that, no, it comes in a husk, and what's the purpose of the husk? It's going to fall 60 to 80 feet in the air. It's going to have an impact on the ground, and it can't break that nut, which is the seed, or the coconut tree won't reproduce itself. So here's a material that has really interesting properties because it's got to absorb a lot of energy. And for those of you that have an engineering background, you understand that's a fairly special kind of a material. It's a very special set of properties that can do that sort of impact absorption for that distance and save the shell. The second thing that we learned along the way was that the shell itself has very unique properties. But let me get into some of the details, and then I brought a bunch of show and tell. Okay, so our basic strategic vision was, how can we help poor coconut farmers create innovative new materials using abundant renewable resources that are underutilized, agricultural waste, and owned by poor farmers who make less than $2 a day? And the first target we came up with, I'm not sure that was doing it on yours too, I don't know why. Well, let's see if we, maybe it'll go away and heal itself. It looks like it did. There's a little small demon in my computer, my wife's computer, that we can't seem to exhort to. Okay, so I think as Christians, we go to poor parts of the world with God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. But for some of these people, that doesn't sound very much like their situation. They have terrible health, they're poor, they're starving, their lives are really difficult. And I think for the gospel to be credible in those kinds of situations, you really have to go with the idea that God loves you and cares about you, and he has sent me here to help you with your material needs as well as with your spiritual needs. And I think that a gospel presented to people who have large physical needs that doesn't include a sort of a more holistic approach is a gospel that's not going to be well received. When Jesus went around, he often commingled these things in a marvelous way, meeting their physical needs but then meeting their spiritual needs, such as the fellow in Mark 2 who gets lowered through the ceiling, and his immediate need was to be able to walk. But his real need was his spiritual deadness. And so I think God can give us some great opportunities. Here's a nice example of a family in Indonesia. I'm the chubby guy on the left. You can see these other guys aren't getting as much to eat as I am, and they're working harder. $500 per year. They typically have 6 children. There's 11 million families in this people group spread out all over the world. And at $500 a year, none of their kids go to school. They can't afford it. The education's free, but they have to buy uniforms. I have no idea why in poor countries they make people wear uniforms. You'd think if you're poor, then you should be able to just come as you are, right? And you have to buy books, and they can't afford to do either. Here's another picture of a bunch of what looked to be pretty happy little Indonesian children. I want to show this to my grandchildren and say, now look how happy these guys are. They don't have iPads, they don't have televisions, they don't have bicycles, they don't have any of the junk you have. And they look like they're really having a pretty good time, you know, playing with sticks and rocks and stuff. But these kids will never, ever go to school. Their lives are very limited. They've been reducing the sizes of the farms for so long now that they're getting subcritically small. Because if you have more than one son, then the farm gets divided. And it gets divided. If you don't have enough land to share with your sons, they go into town, but they've never been to school. Their opportunities are extremely small. Okay, I don't know what this is. It keeps coming up. Okay, so here's basically what we want to do. We want to go figure out a way to use coconuts. 50 billion coconuts a year are harvested around the world. What are they mainly harvested for? Coconut oil. Most of the rest of the stuff is really poorly utilized or not utilized at all. In some cases, it's burnt. In Vietnam, it's dumped into the rivers, and it's stopping up all the rivers. It doesn't do well. This picture shows the percentage of people in the different parts of the world that are making less than $2 a day, and this is the band that where coconuts grow. I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas. I never saw a coconut on a tree. I didn't understand why. You can grow a coconut tree outside that band, but it will be sterile. It will not produce fruit. I used to wonder. I never ran around looking up to be sure I don't get coconuts dropping on my head. It's the fourth leading cause of accidental death in these parts of the world. So here are the different countries. Yeah, you think it's funny, but it's one of those suckers. 4 pounds at about 80 feet, it'll take you out. So Okay, so here's more pictures just showing where coconuts are. And interestingly enough, it maps very well with the place where there's lots of poor people. I like to think of it this way, that we often live in spiritual poverty because although God's provided abundant spiritual resources, we don't see it. We don't access it. I think it's also true in the material world that God sometimes has made abundant provision for us, but if we can't see it, then we can't access it. I think what we're doing is trying to help these people be able to see what God has provided and to be able to use that to have more appropriate material well-being. Okay, so here's a little bit of an anatomy of a coconut cut in two. For those of you that just go shopping in the produce department, this is all you see, okay? If you open it up, it has white coconut meat in it. If you harvest it early, it doesn't have any of this stuff. It just looks like a melon. It has water, so-called coconut water. Very, very good drink, and that's becoming more widely sold. But it really is an empty melon with juice. When you go to places, they'll cut a top off, stick a straw in it, and you drink it straight out of the thing. Ann and I have done this in the Philippines and other places. And it's actually better than Gatorade for electrolytes and other things. It doesn't have any sugar added. In the war, they actually took the coconut water and used it for IVs because it had electrolytes and because it was very clean, very sterile, in places where they really didn't have access to that. Okay, so let's say, what are we going to try to do here? Well, we're going to try to help these people who create this kind of agricultural waste to gain some value out of that. And if you go to places where there are coconuts, I went to a place in Indonesia where they threw away 5 million coconut husks and shells per day. 5 million, that's a lot of biomass. I was talking to my Indonesian Christian business friends there, and I was saying, here's what we can do, and I had all these ideas, and they like, we can give them money for what they now simply throw away as garbage. And he said, no, you don't want to do that. You simply give them a windfall of money, they'll get a second wife. And I thought, oh, crud, I would never have thought of that. This would be make me feel really bad after 10 years of killing myself to make this work, and then find out we've doubled the rate of polygamy in Sumatra, Indonesia. It's not one of my life goals. But they were the ones that said, you know, we could get business people to put in enough money to build schools, staffed with Christians who went to Christian universities there. And if you could have vouchers then, instead of paying a farmer, give them vouchers for their children to go to school, give them fertilizer to grow more production. They could double their production if they had a few things like that, which they don't have. And so they had some really great ideas. It really, really pays to work with in-country people who know what's going on. You can make a lot of big mistakes. Okay, so here's what a coconut husk looks like. This is obviously just a piece of one, but you open up the coconut husk, you pull the nut out, you open up the nut, you scrape the white meat out. Then normally the husk and the shell are discarded. The shell is sometimes used to make charcoal. The husk doesn't have very many applications because it doesn't burn very well. What we're going to do then is to take this, we're going to combine it with the fiber from this with what I'll call a binder fiber. Here's what the coconut fiber looks like in the SCM. Here's what the binder fiber looks like. We're going to compression mold these, and we can essentially take, I'll pass this around, we can take coconut fiber, which has lots of really, really good properties. It has lots of ductility, it has a good bending stiffness. We can combine it with the binder fiber to make that kind of material. We can also take the fiber with the binder fiber, okay, and compression mold parts like this. Now you may think, well, where would you ever use something like that? And I can tell you a bunch of places, door panels in your car, trunk panels, and you open up your lid on your car, the part that you have in there is essentially a compression mold piece like this, except it's made 100% out of synthetics. There's like 5 parts in your car, 2 side panels, a rear panel, a trunk lid, and a deck. And all of those are made out of this kind of material. In some cases, you can use it for underhood things under your car. It's around the dashboard. About 100 pounds a car of non-woven fabric composites, most of which are 100% synthetic, and we simply want to make them 60% natural fiber. So we're working with Ford Motors. We actually got an innovation award with them last November for using more natural materials in parts for automotive. So now, when I pass this around, the thing I want you to take note of is this stuff is really, really stiff. You would not say, when you open the trunk of your car, if this was in there, you wouldn't see it like this because they put on all the stuff to finish your car.
that may look like vinyl, or it may look like a sort of a fuzzy carpet. Mm-hmm. But it's riding on something like this, but maybe on a synthetic. The difference is this is cheaper, it's thicker, and it's green.
So, is it flammable?
It does not burn very well compared to the synthetics, because the synthetics are petroleum based.
Right.
So when we run a burn test, we got 60% of our stuff, 40% vinyl fiber, and what burns? Polypropylene. What's left behind? Charred coconut shell. So it really, it's not impossible to burn it, but it's fairly burn resistant.
Here's another interesting thing about the coconut fiber, just a few details. That's what a coconut fiber looks like in the scanning electron microscope when you cut it open. And you'll notice here, it looks like, now, the cutting it open sort of did a little damage to some of these things, but it's like a whole, it's like a honeycomb structure mm-hmm. along the length of the fiber. That's why it has really good stiffness, but a very low density. So it's got really great mechanical properties. For impact, it has 25% elongation. Most natural fibers have 2% elongation. So its function in nature, not like branches or other things, is to be stiff. Its function is to be energy absorbing. And to be able to do that, then it has these very, very interesting properties, and very different. It's the only fiber that comes out of a fruit. All the others come out of vegetables. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about how you fund projects like this. Somebody asked that a few minutes ago, and the answer is with some difficulty, maybe with great difficulty. If you're interested in doing something like this, it has to have commercial value, but the things we're trying to do, if we're helping poor people in developing countries, have to have commercial value. National Collegiate Inventors and Innovators Alliance provides funding for projects like this. We got about $50,000 from them in a couple of different grants to get us started. Once we were able to get started, then we started a small company when it looked like we had some IP that was going to have real value, and we had really good contacts with some major companies like Ford, who would write letters saying we're really interested in what these people are doing. Then we wrote small business innovative research proposals to the National Science Foundation, and the year we wrote, they had 3,000 proposals, and they funded 400, just to give you an idea of what the percentages are. That was for $100,000, and then we got a $50,000 extension. For the phase two proposal that we wrote for the second year, it's for $500,000, and I think today they doubled all these numbers. We should have done that. I wish they'd done that 3 years ago. Of the 400, they funded 100, and then for the third year, basically their phase 2B, of the 100, they funded 10. And God has blessed us with getting all three of those, so we've got $1.1 million from NSF. So I didn't think there was more than chicken feed money in what we were doing when I started, but I thought, okay, if this is God's project and if he wants to bless it, then he'll find a way. And he found a way. I've never done an SBI before. So, and the first one we wrote, we won. So it's not beginner's luck. It's God's grace. Okay. So here's what we're doing then. We're going to be basically working with taking coconuts with a shell. We're interested in that. People are already taking the coconut and opening it up. We don't have to do the opening up step. We don't have to do the clean all the coke or out step. They're already doing that. They're just throwing away the stuff. So we're going to go and use garbage. When I was in Indonesia, you could get 1,000 coconut husks delivered for $3. Okay? Now, what was the $3 for? It was a delivery charge. The coconuts were free. They put it down at the curb like garbage and hope somebody would come by and pick it up. And the guy who was getting the $3 was the guy who was running the big dump truck with the sideboards. Okay? It was amazing that 5 million per day. I've talked to some major companies who are interested, and they say, well, how much real coconut stuff is there around? And I say, 50 billion coconuts a year. That's about 50 billion kilograms of stuff. Is that enough? Well, yeah, that's okay. Let's go ahead. Well, they don't want to mess with it. If it's a little bitty side thing and there's only a small amount of stuff and they're a great big company, then they don't want to screw around with it. Okay. So you can process the husk. You can make bales of fiber. You can take the fiber, combine it with the binder fiber, and make felt, and then you can compression mold that felt into almost any shapes that you want. So this is one major area that we're looking at. There's a bunch of other areas too, but just to illustrate. And it has very good formability. It has very good burn resistance. One of the big things in natural materials is it has pest resistance. when Mercedes was the first one to put flax in their door panels, and they didn't realize that flax is really something that microorganisms like. And microorganisms then would find their way into that flax. And pretty soon, these brand new Mercedes Benz, after 3 months, smelled like porta potties on wheels because of all the microorganisms. You know what happens when you take your garbage, you put it out, and you leave it in the sun for a while, and it begins to stink like crazy? That's all those microorganisms just sort of eating and doing the usual things that we do with flow through. And it really stunk badly. So it turns out this stuff is like a phenolic resin. It's almost indigestible to most microbials. And I've had a 100 pounds sitting outside our house for 2 years with watering 3 times a week on the sprinkler system and in the sun. We had no smell. So I'm satisfied this stuff will never, ever have a smell problem, which is a big plus compared to other natural materials. Okay, so here's all the great things about the coconut. Well, I don't know why. Let's see if we can... There we go. Okay. Nope. Oops. Okay. In any case, it has great properties, so let me simply say that without getting through all the details. But the main ones are stiffness, strength, odor resistance, burn resistance, microbial resistance, very durable in wet environments. It's got a lot of good properties. Okay, so what would we do with this? Well, same kind of a deal. If you look at this, this is basically a picture of sort of coconut, extracted fiber, and the so-called pith, combined with the binder fiber, make non-wovens, make big rolls of this. It can be made in 150-foot rolls. The company that does this actually exists in Waco and is owned by Christians, so we were easily able to work with them to make stuff. Here's what they now do. They take polypropylene, and polyester, and they combine these into a felt, and then they compression mold it into a trunk lid for a Chevrolet Malibu, for example. All we want to do is to say replace this with the polyester part with coconut fiber. Okay, for those of you that have a little engineering background, I don't want to beat this to death, but the thing we're most interested in is flexural stiffness, and here is coconut fiber composites with a rigidity, an EI value, for those that have an engineering background. Here's what they're using now. Here's the density. Our stuff, remember, it's hollow, so it has a much lower density. But it has a big diameter, which means it has a very good stiffness. The stiffness is a function of the diameter of the fourth nut. And here's where all our stuff is. These are different values depending on how much coconut fiber you put in. So we beat the socks off of what they're now using. We do it at a lower density, which means lighter weight. And if this stuff's sold by the pound, economic savings as well. Now let's talk about coconut shell. When I first thought about coconut shell, I said, what could you use this for? This stuff's really hard. It's 4 times harder than maple, which is the hardest hardwood we have in the United States. Cannonballs, but it's not the 1500s. Okay. It's not quite round, and it's not quite the same all the time. But you've got to be able to do something with something that's that hard. It's got a density of 1.2 grams per cubic centimeter. If you put it in water, it sinks. You ever seen wood that sinks? That's why it's such thin and hard. Yeah. What can we do with it? Well, if it's hard, then I want to use it to take advantage of that. It's also going to be easily formed. Okay, let me pass that around. Make hats for midgets. Okay, so the question is, what can we do with this? Well, we decided we're going to first of all start by converting it into a coconut shell powder. Then we spent a year or two figuring out how to do that. Let me pass this around. This used to be a coconut shell. Okay? And that's been processed into a coconut shell powder, about 50 microns particle size. We can take that coconut shell powder and combine it with some polypropylene, which is just a very common engineering plastic that you use, kind of cheap and has good properties. So we take the powder and the polypropylene, and we combine those, and we make some little pellets that are about 30% coconut shell and about 70% polypropylene. So we're going to take polypropylene, which is a $15 billion a year engineering plastic, and put 30% coconut shell in.
And then we can make all kinds of consumer goods. This is a half a bag gluten, I think. The company was just doing some trials for us, and they said, boy, that runs really well. And so all kinds of consumer goods. You can do door panels for cars. You can do garbage cans. You know, the little roll-out garbage cans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they want that. You see, what color do they come in? Green? Mm-hmm. It has to put pigment in it. Also has problems with ultraviolet light, so they have to add additives for that. Our stuff's very UV resistant. You put our stuff in, you don't have to use UV inhibitors, and you don't have to paint it, because guess what? It comes out brown, okay? And it browns as good as green, and this doesn't cost anything extra. Just as you get this along the way, so you don't have to do anything extra.
Okay, so what does this do for us? Well, to summarize very quickly, it pretty much doubles the stiffness. It retains most of the impact resistance. It increases slightly the tensile strength, which most additives, the additives that they use now are typically things like calcium carbonate or talc or other minerals, sometimes clay. So it has really, really good mechanical properties. Again, it doesn't have any problem with odor, and it's very UV resistant. It's amazing that the coconut shell and the powder have really, really unique properties. It could have been that we did all the properties and we said, you know, this stuff really is trash. And there's nothing we can, I mean, that, we started out realizing there's no guarantees, right? You say it's agricultural waste, and after you screw around with it for 2 years, you say, yes, it really is agricultural waste. And it's, you know, you can't make bricks without straw, and you can't make engineering composites with stuff that has no properties. But fortunately, God has put a wonderful combination of properties into this, and so we're very thankful. We've been on ABC's website and a bunch of other places where we got national publicity, and we've been interviewed, and people say, how did you ever think to use coconut shell and coconut fiber? And I like to pretend that I'm brilliant, you know, and I just saw through all the minutiae of possibilities. And I said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but I work the problem backward. I start with poor coconut farmers, and what do they have? You know, but it worked well. It had taken 10 years to go through the 35 different fibers and try all the different stuff, so we just started with where we could help people. Okay, so here's a good example. Decking for housing, children's toys. We're working with a major toy maker. Garbage cans, the rollout kind, door panels for cars. We are working with a bunch of people right now. Here's just a little bit of mechanical properties, but let's skip it. One of the people said, could you color it? Because we don't think children's toys will look good in brown. And I said, you know, I think you're probably right. I don't think my grandkids would like them. And see, brown is our natural color. So we went to a different company who did colorings, and they said, oh, this stuff colors just fine. I was a little bit afraid all of the dye would go into the coconut powder and not stay in the polypropylene. We didn't know. So we went and tried it, and they said, no, it does fine. No problem. So when people say, can you color it? The answer is, well, of course, what color would you like? And we have a whole bunch of these little pill boxes. When you try that pill box, you're going to find it doesn't open very easily. It's because it's too stiff. It was made for a less stiff material. And by adding the coconut shell, if we were going to really do this commercially, they'd want to make the walls thinner so it would function properly and save extra money. Okay, so let me simply summarize by saying that this has been a terrific opportunity to explore some neat stuff that God has given to poor coconut farmers and helping them to get their full value out of what it is that God's given them. Where are we right now? We've actually started a company. We have raised about $4 million in angel investments. We bought a production facility in Indonesia and another one in the Dominican Republic. We're getting ready to raise about $5 or $6 million more because we are getting some really, really big orders. In one day in April, we got 100,000 pounds worth of orders. Paul wanted it within 30 days. We said, sorry, can't do that. We can't produce that much per month, but we will get there soon. But now we're going to have to go raise a bunch more money because each one of these companies said, I want to buy all your production for this year. And we said, no, we're not going to have one customer. But so we really have a lot of interest from some major, major companies. And so we already have created about 100 jobs in developing countries and 15 jobs in the United States. And God has blessed in a neat way. It's probably the most exciting thing I've ever done. And I've had some pretty exciting things that I've done over the years. So let me stop here while we have just a little bit of time for some questions. let me conclude by simply saying this. Sometimes we dream too small. And if you have small dreams, you're going to have a small, you know, life. And dreaming big doesn't guarantee it will happen, but dreaming small does. Okay? So my suggestion is, pray and ask God to show you. When I went to Baylor from Texas A&M, I went because I wanted to do things that were explicitly Christian, not implicitly. I could have done this at A&M. But it couldn't have been as explicitly Christian, and I wanted it to be that. And I felt like that. But I had no clue because all my experience was working with stuff that was $30 a pound, and this stuff is like 50 cents a pound. So it's a whole new area for me, and I had no idea what I was doing. And I thought, I don't have 30 years to work on this because of my age, and because more recently I had leukemia. So I thought, okay, God, help us to find something that works without, you know, having 20 different trials. And God blessed us in such a huge way that we never ever dreamed we'd be doing what we're doing, and we're raising a bunch more money because we've got so many good opportunities right now. But we need more production, and I mean, we need a lot more production.
What we invested in you would it come back as money for ASA?
Well, you'd have to talk to our CEO. That's not me, our board. But I think right now, all of the people that have invested so far are committed Christians who are doing this. They expect a real return, and it was sold on that basis. But they also understand the total return is going to be partly financial and a lot being a blessing to poor people in developing countries. And if they're not comfortable with that, then we ask them not to invest, because we've made it very clear. We think there's enough big enough pie to slice that the investors can come out well. The employees can be properly taken care of, and I'm talking the ones overseas as well as here, and we can do some really cool things with helping people in developing countries. So that's what we're up to. I wish I was 30 years old instead of 68, but it's never too late. Okay, Jack?
What kind of fertilizer or soil additives do the farmers put into the soil?
Jack, I don't think they do much of anything right now, except maybe they take some of the husk and stuff and try to cut it up and put it back in, because obviously they're depleting the soil when they take away the fruit as it falls. But I don't know that they do. A lot of them don't seem to do very much. And so what happens is the ground gets more and more depleted, or at least the sort of more trace elements that are in the thing. Obviously you get hydrogen and oxygen and carbon from water maybe. But there are other things you need, like potassium and so forth.
The husks and stuff probably don't break down very rapidly.
They don't break down very rapidly, and that's why I'm saying a little bit of fertilizer could probably make a big difference in the yields that they get. It probably wouldn't cost that much, so we're trying to say, what can we do that